I think you're going to find this a very interesting presentation. Besides my 33 years in the labor movement, I try and write some history. And we have some publications over there I want to just call to your attention before I get into the main thing, but this will be brief. My main historical work has been on a fellow named Hubert Harrison, who lived from 1883 to 1927. This is volume one of a two-volume biography, first multi-volume biography of an Afro-Caribbean, only the fifth of an African-American. He is a giant of our history, right? J.A. Rogers in World's Great Men of Color refers to him as the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era. A. Philip Randolph refers to him as the father of Harlem radicalism in the period when Harlem was considered the center of radical black thought, and another phrase was the international Negro Mecca. And he is the major influence on both A. Philip Randolph, radical influence, on both A. Philip Randolph and Marcus Garvey. When I grow up, that's like Martin and Malcolm, right? That's how those lines of descent go. He's the first regular black book reviewer, his phrase was, in Negro newspaperdom. And he's a pioneer soapbox orator, tremendous activist with various organizations, leading black activist in a socialist party for a while. We have the second volume I'm back on tomorrow. I'm back finishing up. I have 1,200 pages. We're going to get that one out. This reader has 137 of his writings. We're putting all 700 on Columbia University's rare book manuscript library for free worldwide. It's a project I'm working on. In this collection, I just want to call to this audience's attention, are a number of articles he wrote for the Boston Chronicle way back, which was a black weekly. And this is in the 20s, and there's some excellent articles, and I think people would find them of particular interest here. So Hubert Harrison is right there. And the other person I write about is Theodore W. Allen. Here's a picture of Allen. Together, these two, I think, are two of the very most important writers on race and class in the 20th century. They are anti-white supremacist, working class intellectuals. They are both autodidacts. Harrison, although Rogers calls him the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era, never went to college a day in his life. Allen went one day and found it too confining. Right? They're brilliant. And so we're going to get into what we're going to focus on today is Allen's The Invention of the White Race, this two-volume work. This is his magnum opus, written volume one when he's 75, volume two when he's 78. So he's an inspiration for us all here. Right? And there he is, I think, around the time volume one was coming out. He died at age 85 into this. So here he lives from 1919 to 2005. What we're looking at is about a 40-minute presentation. Allen lives from 1919 to 2005. Very briefly, he's born in Indianapolis. His family, during the Depression, moves to Huntington, West Virginia, where he graduates from high school. He emphasizes how he's, quote, proletarianized by the Great Depression, and he graduates from high school and becomes a coal miner, right? And now, what I'm going to say today in this presentation, I thank you for mentioning the webpage, right? But it's drawn from this article I wrote. It started out as a solicited 2,500-word piece for a publication called Daedalus, and there's a whole story which I detail at the back. But it turned into a 117-page article. You can get the PDF for free online. But it's on Allen's thought. The article is Developing Conjuncture, Developing Crisis, and Some Insights from Hubert Harrison, Theodore W. Allen, on the centrality of the fight against white supremacy. It's available for free on my webpage, and it's probably the most in-depth treatment of Allen's work. All right, Allen is a working-class intellectual activist, as I said, an autodidact. He's a coal miner. He becomes president of three different UMW, United Mine Workers locals, till he hurts his backs in mines, ultimately comes up to New York, lives his last 50 years, if people are familiar with New York, on Brooklyn and Dean Street, right? And that's where he lives, that's where he's rooted. He does some teaching, he's a postal worker, he's a librarian, he did the homework hotline when he was in his 70s for the youth of Brooklyn, right, from the public library. He is the originator of the white skin privilege analysis, and he does this in 65 and 67. Some people may think they're familiar with it, or they may go on to Wikipedia and hear all this talk about the invisible knapsack in 1986 and 87, but Allen develops an analysis, the original analysis, in 1965 and 67, and it's rooted in class analysis also, which we're going to get into and I'm going to explain. But it's important to know that, I think, he originates the invention of the white race analysis, first articulated in this pamphlet. Again, we have everything. Everything's at cost, too, when we do this, right? And this pamphlet was, I think, the first formal publication of it. It was a talk at Yale University he gave. And then it was, again, a Boston connection. The Radical America publication used to come out of Boston in that period that published it first. And we've put it out in pamphlet form from the Center for Study of Working Class Life at SUNY Stony Brook. He writes this two-volume work in 1994 and 1997, The Invention of the White Race, and these new editions came out in, I think, December of last year. And I was asked, because I knew Alan, I have all his papers, I was pretty familiar with all his work, and, you know, helped him some. I was asked to do, and did, I provided new introductions, new back matter, very deep and extensive, broad and deep indexes. And what I did, what I think is particularly helpful, because I've tried, you know, we've taught this a few times, is I put 25-page internal study guides in each volume. So I think the new volume is, you know, really worth engaging. Volume one, and pay attention, Alan's very precise with his words. Volume one is racial oppression and social control. And volume two is the origin, singular, of racial oppression in Anglo-America, right? And finally, aside from the introductions I provide in these works and what we're going to go over today, you should know that he himself did a summary of the argument of the invention of the white race, two parts, online, free. All this is freely available on my webpage. And those two-part summaries are each 50 pages long. So he gets into it. All right, here we go. Alan writes, when the book first comes out, Volume 1 in 1994, he writes on the back cover of Volume 1, when the first Africans arrived in Virginia in 1619, there were no white people there, nor would there be, according to the colonial records, for another 60 years. He went through. Now, Alan is what I call a good proletarian scholar. He was not, you know, pushing for any, you know, book for tenure or anything like that, under no deadline. He really wanted to pursue these issues deeply. He spent over 20 years going through primary records from colonial Virginia. And he would go and he would actually transcribe the originals, then come back and type them. And I have this entire body, thousands of pages of typed up, you know, I mean, this is a major collection. And he did it with an eye looking for where laboring people, European American and African American, had a voice in the colonial record, because he's coming from that perspective. So he goes through all these records, and he goes through 885 county years. You pick one of the existing counties of Virginia, Accomack County, for instance, and he would go through all the records for 1 year. That's one county year of records. He went through 885 county years. The word white as a symbol of social status does not appear until 1691, right? But it's not simply that the word doesn't appear. The white race, as we know it, was not functioning. And he develops that point. And he's not the only one, as we're going to see. But I want to just, and what he basically argues is the following. Others living in the colony at that time were English. They had been English when they left England. And their children would be English. They were not white. White identity had to be carefully taught. And it would be another 60 years before the word would even begin to appear as a synonym for European American. Drive that point home a little more. People may be familiar with about 8 months ago. There was Ancestry.com did a little piece about a fellow named John Punch, an ancestor of Barack Obama. This gave it added interest. Who in 1640, after running away with two co-conspirators, was sentenced to lifetime bondage, right, in Virginia. John Punch is of African descent. And what the Ancestry.com did a big thing, that they played up a lot, was of particular interest to some people, was the fact that it was based on the fact that his relationship to Barack Obama was on Barack Obama's mother's side, on the maternal side, right, rather than his father's side. But this is the only existing record of John Punch from 1640, the only place he appears in any of the records. And just to highlight what is, elaborating on the point I'm making, the two people he runs away with are Victor, a Dutchman, and a Scotchman called James Gregory. Still not white, right? Next big document I want to just point you to is the account of a fellow named Thomas Grantham. We're going to come back to Bacon's Rebellion. It's a very important event in 17th century Virginia. And I want to say, when Alan focuses on Virginia, it's important to understand that Virginia is the pattern-setting colony, right? This sets the pattern for race relations as developed in the U.S., in the southern U.S. at first. And the big event that he will focus on is Bacon's Rebellion, but in the final stages of Bacon's Rebellion, when Grantham is sent to put down the struggle, it's a joint struggle in the Civil War, in the latter stages of the struggle, where European Americans and African Americans are fighting together, demanding their freedom from bondage, something you wouldn't see for the next 300 years, or 200 at least. When he records what happened, he says, "I there met 400 English and Negroes in arms who were much dissatisfied. Some were for shooting me, others were for cutting me in pieces. Then he promised them that they were all pardoned and freed from their slavery, and in the final stages, 80 Negroes and 20 English would not deliver their arms." Still not white, right? These are the records. All right. Allen's main thesis in the invention of the white race, his three main theses, because I want to get these out, and then we're going to come back and look how he gets there. The first and most important is that the white race was invented as a ruling class social control formation in response to labor solidarity as manifested in the latter Civil War stages of Bacon's Rebellion. What's very crucial in this analysis is ruling class social control. Many people have heard, it's now a cliche in some circles, that race is a social construct. But Alan says it's crucial to understand that it is the ruling class that drove this, because otherwise, if you just say it's a social construct, you leave the back door open for all kinds of analysis about cultural dysfunctionality and sociobiological factors and things like that. So he's very emphatic about that ruling class. Second, the way it was done was a system of racial privileges was deliberately instituted by the late 17th, early 18th century Anglo-American bourgeoisie. And he uses that phrase because it's under capitalist relations of production, which we'll also discuss. And they did this in order to define and establish the white race and establish a system of racial oppression. And I'll briefly explain what he means by racial oppression in a few minutes. The consequence, and this is the third and very crucial to Allen's analysis, the consequence of this course, of this policy, was ruinous not only to the interest of African Americans, but it was disastrous for European American workers. He's clear the ruling class benefits from this situation, right? But for workers, he's making the argument it's not in their interest, and it wasn't in their interest. He also contends, and there are many contentions he makes, but I'll just briefly mention a few others. The European American worker's own position vis-a-vis the rich and powerful was not improved, but was weakened by the white skin privilege system. The invention of the white race was political and no part of genetic evolution. The white race must be understood, as I emphasized before, not simply as a social construct, but as a ruling class social control formation. And he also goes on in his analysis, which is crucial to us today as we try and, you know, make for a better world, that the white race has served as the principal historic guarantor of ruling class domination of national life in the U.S. So this is where he's taking this analysis. Here's the story of how he comes to write the book. And this is from, in his own words, he's describing how he comes to write it. And he writes this talking about the period around 1965 when he starts developing the analysis. And what he says, I think probably virtually everyone in this room could relate to, right? He says, "I started out, I had a little fascination with history, had a long time identification with the ordinary people, and I had a conviction that racial discrimination is a bad thing." Probably a unifying factor, you know, for the church, right? It was a changed atmosphere, however, because it's in the 1960s and it's influenced by the civil rights, black liberation struggle, the anti-war movement, the student movement, and all those movements the civil rights movement and black liberation struggle was a catalyst for the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the labor movement. All those movements took sustenance from that important struggle, and that's the atmosphere he's writing in. And he sets out early, he's trying to look at why have we not been more effective in this country at efforts at social change. And he wants to take a look, and he starts, you know, putting forth in his mind the thesis that the reason has been white supremacy has been the principal explanation. So what he undertakes is to look at three previous crises. And this is why I think this is important, because I think we're moving into the fourth great crisis now, right? And the three previous crises he looks at are the 1870s, 1890s, and the 1930s. Without going into great detail in all three, here's basically what he found. And this is all detailed with footnotes and documents in my article that I cited at the beginning from on my webpage, top left. In the three periods of national crisis characterized by general confrontations between capital and urban and rural laboring classes, the key to defeat of the forces of democracy, labor, and socialism was in each case achieved by ruling class appeals to white supremacism, basically by fostering white skin privileges of laboring class European Americans. He says that's the key to defeat. So that's he's working under that analysis. And I just want to elaborate on that a little. I want to give you one example that people here may be familiar with. The Great Depression. In the Great Depression, we know people came together, they started struggling, they were pushing, you know, for improved conditions. But on the notion that Allen's developing of how white supremacism was central to defeat, here are some examples. One, all of the major... A fellow named Ira Katznelson at Columbia University has written a book, When Affirmative Action Was White. He describes in that book how each and every program and policy of the federal government from the 1930s into the 1960s was shaped in a white supremacist fashion. Key examples, and I come out of the labor movement, the National Labor Relations Act, the Fair Labor Standards Act, and Social Security until 1951, all excluded agricultural and domestic workers. 75% of your black labor force down south, 60% nationwide. Relief. Relief money was federal money, but it was controlled locally, which meant there was great disparity, particularly in the south. Another one, and this one, it rings true to me because I grew up in the New York, North Jersey area, the GI Bill. People may be familiar. Under the GI Bill, you get a home with zero down payment and low interest loan. The statistics for the New York, New Jersey area on the GI Bill are 67,000 GI loans were awarded. Less than 100 go to families of color. And that's how you get the ring of white suburbs around New York and every city in this country. And finally, a last thing I want to point out before we move on, and this one I think is crucial, and I don't think people have paid enough attention to, and Allen points this out. At the start of the Depression in 1929, the black-to-white unemployment ratio was 1-to-1, which if you think about it makes sense, since black people are brought to America, you know, the country to labor, right? By 1947, after all those programs of the New Deal and the post-war redeployment, the ratio is 2-to-1, and since, as long as I've been alive, and basically anyone in this room, that's all we've known is 2-to-1 or some variant of it. Conscious ruling class policy. Why? Because even FDR's New Deal, his troika, his three legs of support, one of the key ingredients was those Southern Dixiecrats shaping everything, right? We still got problems like that today, right? All right. Allen at one point makes the argument, and then we're going to get right into the invention of the white race. But he says, you know, he tries to get a little overview of it, and he says if we take a look at what's happened historically, normal course of capitalist developments, there's a deterioration of conditions, the substance of the white workers' race privileges at a certain point really starts to erode, and then there's overtures towards unity. In number three, he says what has historically happened is stage four, that when these overtures to unity, and we see little bits of this maybe in the Occupy movement or in Madison or things like this, people start to talk, oh, we got to come together, you know, we've got issues. And then what has happened historically is the ruling class has moved to resubstantiate the white race privileges, as I just described. And then unfortunately, historically, what he says has happened is the white workers have taken, and he refers to the white race privileges as a poison bait. Like a shot of heroin. They look good, but they're not. They're not in your interest, right? So, going on now with the history of Allen's book. So this is where he's writing about these three crises, and it's the late 60s, and all of a sudden the ideological response from the academy, from the universities, comes forth. This is the response to the civil rights black liberation struggle. And one of the main assaults comes from this fellow named Winthrop Jordan, Winthrop D. Jordan. Writes a book, wins a National Book Award and two or three other major national prizes, right? The title of the book is White Over Black, American Attitudes Towards the Negro, 1550 to 1812. You can see by the title he's equating white with American, right? And the essence of that book is that racism is an unthinking decision, that racism is innate. And of course, if racism is innate, why fight it? You can't do anything about it, right? And this is crucial to the attack, right? Because he's trying to take the heart out of struggle against white supremacy. And Allen felt he had to drop what he was doing. He has a major book-length manuscript unfinished on those three crises, and he says, I have to go back to the 17th century because I have to deal with Jordan. Now, in the course of dealing with Jordan and going back to the 17th century, Allen takes on what I think are the two, and what he thought, are the two major ideological props of white supremacy amongst European American workers, right? Because he's really particularly trying to reach working people. And one is the idea that racism is innate. As I said, if racism is innate, why fight it? The second argument is the idea that white workers, quote, benefit from white race privileges. Because if it's in their interest, why should they fight it, right? So this is the arguments he's got to go after. He feels he's got to go after. And again, Allen argues for European American workers, the race privileges are a poison bait like a shot of heroin. Now, historically, these arguments that Allen's going to take on, and you have to remember, this is a coal miner, never went to college one day, he's working far outside the academy. He's going to take on Jordan, the argument about the unthinking decision, and for the second argument about that white workers benefit, he's going to challenge the work of Edmund S. Morgan, Yale Emeritus, President of the Organization of American Historians, and his book is very influential, American Slavery and American Freedom. And there is much good in Morgan's, you know, it's a major contribution what Morgan has done. But at a key point, particularly when he's dealing about the 18th century, Morgan makes the argument there were too few free, poor European Americans on hand to matter, as if they're being promoted into the middle class. That is a situation, when I write about Harrison, that's a situation in St. Croix, it's a situation in Barbados and Jamaica and the Anglo-Caribbean, that is not the situation in Virginia. We got southern poor whites. Going on, so here we are, Allen, ready to write his book. You see where, you know, some of his background, where he's coming from. All right, volume one, Racial Oppression and Social Control. I'm just gonna briefly go through what he does. Hopefully you'll get a chance to take a look at the books or we get them in the libraries, we make sure people can access them. He offers a critical analysis, two main lines of debate on the relations of slavery and racism debate. The psychocultural, the racism is innate, that's Jordan, a fellow named Degler, people like that. He's very critical of that position. And he thinks that of the socioeconomic approach, much of the best work has been done, but he goes through each one and points out areas where he thinks they're weak. Now, one thing I want to say about Allen is he is not mean-spirited. And what he does, he understands the arguments that are out there. And what he tries to do is raise them in their best light and then treat them with respect and seriously and, you know, see what stands and what doesn't stand with them. Again, what appeals to me about both Harrison and Allen is their great intellectual integrity. And I think that would appeal to people in this congregation. Now, Allen's conclusions, he's not alone in this, because much of what he finds, and he cites this and points to it, is elaborated by a historian named Lerone Bennett Jr. Some people may be familiar with him, senior editor of Ebony Magazine for many, many years, retired from that position now. He wrote Before the Mayflower, a book which many people have read in college courses. And the book that Allen particularly likes is Bennett's The Shaping of Black America, Chapter 3, The Road Not Taken, which develops many of the same points that Allen. But Bennett, because he's working full-time in Chicago and maybe didn't have full access to those resources down south, didn't have all that time doing all that primary research. But Bennett sums it up with essentially the same three points that Allen does, right? Okay, then Allen goes in his book, Volume 1, and he wants to look at some of the absurdities of race. I'm going to do this quickly. I'm going to just point out four examples. You with me so far? Are we okay? All right. Okay, he talks about how in colonial Hispanic America, it was possible, as the saying goes, to purchase certificates of whiteness. In Brazil, it was said money whitens. In the U.S., no such whitening occurred. In 1890, a Portuguese immigrant settling in Guyana, British Guiana at the time, would learn that he or she was not white, but a sibling would come to the U.S. and would be defined as white in that situation. The next one is one I particularly like. Same country, same year, Cuba, 1907. In the last Spanish census, Mexican Indians and Chinese were classified as white. In 1907, Cuba, first U.S. census, right? The Spanish are on their way out. The U.S. is coming in. And the first U.S. census classifies these groups as colored. And then just one other example, but he has many. Virginia laws, and this is all the torturous definitions they go through to try and define, quote, who's white, who's a Negro. In 1860, a person with three grandparents was a Negro. By 1907, 15 out of 16 white great-grandparents still classified as a Negro. And then I think in 1910, they're moving any ascertainable Negro blood, the so-called one-drop rule, and there are many variants of this. So what Allen then seeks to do is, in the face of such absurdities, he wants to take a look at the nature of the oppression. He goes, well, look, we got to move beyond this because, you know, this is a lot of inconsistencies in the skin-based phenomenon. And this is crucial because in addressing white supremacism, he knows that so much is ingrained in terms of, you know, viewing people in terms of skin pigmentation stuff. So he wants to look at the nature of the oppression, and he focuses primarily not on why the bourgeoisie had recourse to slavery, but rather on how they could establish that degree of social control. And just to drive this point home a little bit, in Volume 1 and Volume 2, we're going to get certainly into the treatment of enslaved Africans. But you should know, if you're not familiar, that in 1547 to 1550, the English enslave English, their own English vagabonds. From early first decade of the 1600s to the last decades of the 1700s, there are Scottish coal miners and salt pan workers enslaved. In the 1650s, there's the Irish slave trade. So Allen is very clear that the ruling class will do what they can get away with, right? You know, if they... And his core argument in Volume 1, and Volume 1, his main work is Volume 2. That's when he documents what goes on in the 17th century. But in Volume 1, he's taking a broader theoretical look. And what he does in his core argument in Volume 1 is that by examining Anglo-Norman rule going back to the 1300s and Protestant ascendancy in Ireland, Protestant ascendancy is what gets developed particularly in the 1700s, Protestants ascendant over Irish Catholics, and white supremacy in continental Anglo-America, looking for this pointer, demonstrates that racial oppression is not dependent on differences of phenotype. He's arguing that the oppression is similar, extraordinarily similar, but in the one case, you have people of the same phenotype against people, but he even goes further. In the other case, people of different phenotype. He goes through what he considers four defining characteristics. I'm not going to go into all of this, but just declassing legislation, deprivation of civil rights, illegalization of literacy, displacement of family rights, and goes concrete, example by example, in both cases. But he also makes a difference, in his mind, between racial oppression and
national
oppression. And this is where this social control analysis comes in. Because he says under racial oppression, what is done, and this is what we saw in the South, you know, in the early period after it gets established, is the oppression is maintained. The key ingredient is the laboring class of the oppressor group. That's racial oppression. Under national oppression, drawn into the social control formation, is a sector of the oppressed group. Very important. So this is what Allen goes, and we can talk about this in Q&A. In Virginia, any person of discernible European, non-European ancestry were denied a role in the social control. The slave patrol was lily white by definition, right? Under national oppression in the Anglo-Caribbean, mulattoes were included in, so-called mulattoes, free colored, were included in social group and were promoted into the middle class. Marked contrast, we can go more specifically into this. Prime examples, Harrison, St. Croix, Barbados, Jamaica. So here's what Allen has done in his first volume, his theoretical volume. He has argued that religio-racial oppression was established by the same European English bourgeoisie established religio-racial oppression against Irish Catholics, people of the same phenotype. They established national oppression in the Anglo-Caribbean. They established racial oppression in the southern U.S., right? They'll devise different means of social control. He also argues in Volume 1 how in the early 1800s there is a transition from racial oppression in Ireland to national oppression. They draw the Irish national bourgeoisie for most of the country, but they maintain that racial oppression in Ulster as their base, their anchor of support. And then the final thing he does, and he's talking about New York, and I know we have a history here of Boston too, which people may be able to fill in more, but he talks about how the same people who are victims of racial oppression in Ireland come to the U.S. and become opponents of abolition and supporters of racial oppression, and he goes through that in some detail, 1840s, 50s, and 60s in New York. He calls it the sea change, the Irish sea change, but when he details this and describes it, it's not these pseudo-labor competition arguments, because the main competition for Irish laborers was from other European immigrants, you know. But he points out the role of the ruling class elements, the slave plantation slaveocracy with great ties to New York. Fernando Wood, the mayor of New York, is a big supporter of the slave plantation society in the South. The role of the Catholic Church hierarchy, the Irish American established, the Catholic press, and Tammany Hall. So Allen goes through all this. We're just about ready. His last thing he does in Volume 1 is he talks about how after emancipation, the Civil War, the northern bourgeoisie, which now has power, opts to move the way the South had done more formally in terms of their system of social control, and they do so by setting up whole systems of privilege in terms of land, immigration, industrial employment. That's what Allen does in the first volume. Now we go to Volume 2, and this is, he calls it, this is the best of me. That's what he writes. He says, this is what I, you know, worked, he was working all these years on. Allen put the word origin in the title, not origins, and here's his reason why. He says it has the desired specificity, and he cites Darwin's The Origin of Species, he cites Engels' The Origin of Family, and he says, in choosing the subtitle, I meant it to be consistent with the argument of the book. The class struggle is, the origin of racial oppression is in class struggle, right? This is so he's not, you know, all over the place with where his focus is. And he goes and he argues it's in class struggle rather than as understanding racial oppression as natural or some pre-American prejudice or the like. So in The Invention of the White Race, we have about 15 more minutes, so people with me? All right, we're okay? All right. In The Invention of the White Race, what he's going to focus on are the key events are the founding of Jamestown in 1607, and he will go up through 1750. Georgia goes, it's a very checkered history. We're not going to get into all this today, but they go through all different types of approaches to the question. But key events in the invention of the white race are 1622, the reduction to chattel labor status of laboring people and tenants in Virginia, we'll speak about, Bacon's Rebellion, and by 1705, they are formally codifying new laws, systematizing the whole system of racial oppression. When Allen does his background, he develops a nice analysis and does a nice review for readers of the development of capitalism in England, because it's important to understand that what gets set up in Virginia is under capitalist relations of production. This is not ancient slavery. This is not a feudal carryover, what is going to develop. It's under capitalism. And so he goes through and documents, particularly in terms of the closing of the monasteries, the development of the cloth industry, capitalism in agriculture, enclosures. He reviews a lot of that history, which people may be familiar with, and all being influenced constantly by class struggle. In terms of class struggle in England, what's crucial to know is in 1563, the major labor law, which was to prevail for the next 250 years, was established in England. And this is the one that impacts the colonists who come to Virginia. And two key provisions of it are that there would be no slavery and laborers were to be paid wages. This is English law, right? This is what they're bringing with them to Virginia. All right. Allen goes through in wonderful detail, we're not going to do it here unless we have more time later, and he goes through comparisons of how social relations and social control are established in different places and why the differences. And he goes through Haiti, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Mexico, Peru, Brazil. Amongst some of the factors that he calls attention to are things like whether we're talking about a continental colony or an island, whether the Native American society is stratified or not, because he's in Mexico, the Spanish, you know, with the Inca and Aztecs have a different experience than, you know, other people, because they're encountering a society of significant stratification, whether it is high or low population density of the native population. Key thing that's crucial to understanding race relations as they develop in this country is the following. England alone, of all the European colonizing powers, was exporting laboring people from their homeland, right? The Portuguese don't do it. Spanish don't do it. The French don't do it. Dutch don't do it, right? This is a distinguishing factor and crucial to the race relations we now know. What's, quote, race relations, right? All right, in the Virginia Company Charter, as it's initially set up in 1606, before even the founding, but they renew it twice more, right? The colonists shall have all liberties, franchises, and immunities of free denizens of natural rights of England. They got the rights, so-called rights of an Englishman, if you will, right? Now, the Native Americans in the area of Jamestown, the Powhatan Indians, were well-provisioned. They had helped, as happened in Massachusetts, I think, they helped people, you know, survive in the early periods, the starving period. And in the first decade or two, the English lacked the preponderance of power. They weren't coming as the Spanish did, you know, with bayonets and things like this. So the relations were of a different nature. They were less stratified society, less population density, and a whole continental expanse. So they were not going to be the English. To make profit under capitalism, you need labor, right? And they were not going to be the labor force that the English could use. And he goes into that. In the early period, tobacco is first, you know, cultivated in 1616 in Virginia, right? And in the next few years, there are some efforts at bringing in more vulnerable population. And he discusses some of these, including imprisoned convicts, vagrants, maids for wives, women being shipped over, duty boys, that's youth. But the big event in this early period, this date right here, 22 March 1622, on that date, the Native Americans in the area of Jamestown rise up and kill one-third of the colonists in one day. And within the next year, another one-third would die. And what this meant is, after this date, If you're part of the Virginia colony, there were great restrictions. You couldn't even go out and grow corn, which was the main subsistence food, because that would provide cover, you know, for Native Americans if they wanted to attack. People were increasingly limited to the confines of the fort. They were totally dependent on those who controlled the supplies. And people today may be familiar with the work of Naomi Klein, shock doctrine. That's essentially what was done back then, because the ruling elite took advantage of this vulnerability of the colonists, the laboring class colonists, and they imposed a new status of labor. In Virginia, in the early period, under capitalism, and from 1616, and Allen details in some of the records, for laboring people, the basic relations of production were free wage earners, but even more common than that, were tenants at half. You work, you know, you keep half of what you produce, and you turn over half. So what happens is new words start to appear in the records. And you see people, you see the words heirs and assigns. Assign means somebody can be assigned to somebody else. You can be bought and sold. You are now property. And this is primarily on European Americans in this period, because there aren't that many African Americans. Very few, as a matter of fact, in the early period. So this is a qualitative change in labor relations typical form of Virginia at the beginning was that of tenant, as I said. By the spring of 1622, they're trying to reduce very systematically and consistently tenants to servants. Allen refers to it as the massacre of the tenants. And just as they do today, they euphemize what they're doing a little. It's called the custom of the country. But what I want to point out, these are not indentures. These are not people willingly signing pieces of paper in London to put themselves in servitude. It's being imposed here. As a matter of fact, the cost of transportation from England to Virginia would have been paid off six times in the first year, you know, but I know we've all been taught indentured, because it's another way to differentiate the laborers, indentured servants versus slaves, right? I mean, it's the way it's been taught oftentimes. So what Allen's arguing is this chattel bond servitude is a qualitative break from English labor law. It's a break from the Statute of Artificers, 1563. It is not a feudal carryover. Under feudalism, there's a two-way bond. There's an obligation of the servant, of the serf to the lord, and the lord to the serf. This is one way. If you're a laboring person, you can be bought and sold, right? And it's not an apprenticeship. So this is qualitatively new. We're going to have a few more qualitatively new things. So here's some of the statistics of 92,000 European immigrants brought to Virginia between 1607 and 1682, mostly to Virginia. Over three quarters were chattel bond laborers, right? The great majority of them in English. In 1676, the year the Bacon's Rebellion starts, 1,500 are coming a year. Such recruitment was generally coercive. Few were wholehearted volunteers with written contracts. Many were kidnapped, some were ordinary convicts, still others prisoners taken in wars and debt. All right. One other thing I want to point out, and throughout these volumes, and we're not going to go into great detail now with our time, but Allen pays attention to women, the oppression of women, and if you go particularly in that second volume through the table of contents, you're going to find many eye-opening things. But one, and this one I want to just call your attention to, in this early period, when the chattel bond servitude, the length of the servitude is 3, 4, 5 years, maybe more, 6 years if you're vulnerable, right? If you're Irish, if you're African, perhaps they're going to try and extend it. If you're a woman, and women get harsher penalties. He goes through all of this. But one interesting thing in this early period, and we're going to develop this a little bit later, is marriage was prohibited for these bond servants. Fornication and adultery were prohibited. No family life, no sex relations at all. Why? Because if you're a woman and you get pregnant, that's time off from work. You're working 5 years or 6 years. Later on, when they turn to the system of full-time racial slavery, it's very different, because then we're going to get into that. Then you're producing another generation of
enslaved
labor, right? So in 17th century Virginia, this is another point that Allen makes and Lerone Bennett makes it in that shaping of Black America. And Morgan makes it for the most part, right? Boy, in 17th century Virginia. And they're not the only ones, but the lives of African-American and European-American laborers and chattel bond servants were very similar throughout 1676, at which time three-quarters of the chattel bond servants were European. So this is, Allen's describing a period. This is not what we saw on TV with the Kunta Kinte and the roots phenomenon, when it's a full-blown system. This is before that is developed, right? Like everything, things have beginnings in history. Life expectancy of the bond servants was very low. Conditions were very hard in these periods. In the 17th century, most of the plantation laborers were bond servants. The status of African Americans in the 17th century, and people may be surprised by this, maybe not, maybe people know this history, but it was, Allen says, and he uses the phrase, indeterminate. It's still being struggled out. It was not clear. Much similarity with the European Americans. African Americans exercised marriage rights, social mobility. Some had significant land holdings. Some were owners of European American bond laborers. They manifested many forms of resistance, running away, petitioning in courts, et cetera, et cetera. African Americans with property could vote in Virginia in the 17th century, and that's going to become important in what happens later on. The status of African Americans was indeterminate. This is what Allen argues. And it was being fought out in the issue of slavery versus freedom. So that's that point, once again, indeterminate. Here's an extraordinarily important case Again, most people don't know. It's got to do with family relations. It's the case of Elizabeth Key. Elizabeth Key is a woman whose father was European-American, mother was African-American, or European and African. And she was serving a period. She was a limited-term bond servant. Her parents passed away. To make the story short, the people who had title to her status, right, tried to impose lifetime bond servitude on her. So she goes into court. She could petition, right? She had that right. She goes into court, and she petitions on two grounds. One, that she had been baptized, and there was some tradition of people not being supposed to be enslaved if they had been baptized, although it was not consistent. But the second argument she makes is that her father had been free, and English common law for centuries was partus sequitur patrum, forgive my Latin. Status of the child follows that of the father, right? She goes, I should be free. And she wins. She prevails in 1656. The ruling elite knows they can't have, this is not the direction they want to move, but so by 1662, they change it, and they change it to partus sequitur ventrum. Status follows the status of the mother, so when all those plantation owners and overseers and whatever are taking advantage, particularly as the time wears on, of African women, African-American women, those children are enslaved. Now, there's a fellow named Gutman, people may, you know, writes a book that Black Family and Slavery and Freedom starts in 1790, excuse me. You can't ignore such a qualitative change and tell that story, in my opinion, right? So, going on. So there's Elizabeth Key. So Allen's arguing the white race did not exist, and he emphasizes the attitude of the laboring class European Americans stood in sharp contrast. So a lot of times we're told history of the 17th century, white this and white that. They weren't even being called white, and there was marked differences in perspectives from the laboring people and the plantation owners. And so Allen argues that the invention of the white race at the beginning of the 18th century can in no part be ascribed to demand for that from European-American laboring people, or even their pushing demands for privileges vis-a-vis the African-Americans. The number of bond laborers was increasing. 1671, 8,000 of the 15,000 tithables in Virginia were bond laborers. At that point, it's still three-quarters of them are European-Americans. It's in the 1670s that the Royal African Company is founded. So that opens the door for more turn to African labor, because African labor wasn't so accessible to Virginia in the early period. That's why they were bringing so many European bond laborers. But even in the period finishing out the 17th century, still the majority of bond laborers coming are European. It's after that we really see the marked change, right? Here's Bacon's Rebellion. This is the big struggle. Bacon's Rebellion starts out as a struggle within the ruling elite, the elite and the sub-elite. The elite, as is so often the case, likes things the way they are. They like relations the way they are. They actually tried to maintain friendly relations with neighboring Native American tribes, and the reason was the Native Americans could then help control plantation, chattel bond servants, prevent runaways. Because always social control, you got the continental expanse, right? The plantation sub-elite, the people on the make, the next generation, they wanted to aggressively go after Native American lands and develop plantations. So that's how the struggle starts. It's not a great beginning, but it so often happens in these struggles, it's the second Civil War stage, which is so crucial. And in that stage, you have the laboring people really enter the fray, and you have the laboring class and bond servant people pushing from below. They kick out the governor. They burn Jamestown. They control 6/7 of the colony of Virginia for 9 months. Right? This is class struggle. And here's the governor. The governor Barclay writes, 6/7 at least of the people are poor, indebted, discontented, and armed. Not a very favorable situation. And they don't have an established system of social control. Because you've got a separation in society between the plantation elite, but most everybody else is working, whether it's for themselves or for somebody else, right? So it's not like people are going to be available to maintain social control very easily, right? So, and again, Allen's discussing all that. So what happens in response and in the wake of Bacon's Rebellion is the codification of white supremacy. The ruling class takes measures to set up this system of, to start extending a system of privileges and to really create this white identity, to set European American laborers and bond laborers at a distance from African American bond laborers, and to also enlist the European Americans as supporters of the whole plantation system. The codification. So here's some of the privileges that get instituted over the next period of time. Presumption of liberty, right to get married, right to carry a gun, etc., etc. What's crucial to understanding racial oppression is not simply the move towards extending the servitude of the African bond laborers towards life, but it's the attacks on the free African Americans. And this is what's really key to understanding racial oppression, because and there's a whole series of laws against free African Americans. I'm going to explain why in a second, right? Propaganda and the ruling class, people just didn't come to this naturally. The ruling class was very systematic in propagandizing people in this. And the main means of mass communication back then, here they are, parish clerks or church wardens would put these, to the congregants, and the sheriffs would post them on the courthouse doors, and people were, was drummed in, and the laws were passed. The general public was regularly and systematically subjected to official, pronouncements on this. All right, but here's a key document now, 1723. The key codifications of Virginia laws were 1705 and 1723. In 1723, the Virginia Assembly passed an act, no free Negro, mulatto, or Indian whatsoever shall have any vote in the election. Even in England, they didn't understand why that was being done. They write to Virginia and they say, explain this. If people own property, why aren't they allowed to vote? And because it was being done differently elsewhere, in the Americas. And the governor of Virginia, William Gooch, sets them straight. And he explains that this was done to fix a perpetual brand upon free Negroes and mulattoes. Here's what Allen says. Surely that was no unthinking decision. That's a reference to Winthrop Jordan, right? Conscious ruling class policy. Deliberate act by the bourgeoisie, and it repealed an electoral principle that had existed in Virginia for more than a century. All right, just going on. Another key component of that 1723 codification was the right of self-defense would be taken away from people of African descent in its entirety, and that opens the door for much more aggressive attacks, particularly on African-American women, and leads, to the principle that essentially was put in place that any European-American male could assume familiarity with any African-American woman. Why the exclusion of free African-Americans? Why did they take this law against the free African-Americans? Well, Allen explains, they're trying to create pride in this white thing. They're trying to separate this white thing from Negro, right? And so the exclusions of free African-Americans from the intermediate stratum, the social control, was a corollary of the establishment of white identity. That's crucial to understanding what they're doing to create the white identity. So now on the question of the laboring class European Americans not being promoted out of their class, again, this is in response to Morgan, who I talked about earlier. Allen cites the work of very well-known and well-respected historians who studied this, Jackson Turner Main, Aubrey C. Land. About 50% of the adult white male population were not owners of bond laborers, but were in direct competition. People were not being promoted, out of their class. The white race is a social control formation that was established in Virginia, would over time serve as a model for each successive plantation region. He elaborates on this much more. At the end of his book, 1997, what he writes in 1997 at age 78 is still relevant today, 16 years later. I mean, it's just listen here. He goes, now at the end of the 20th century, the social gap between the Titans and the common people is perhaps at historic proportions. Real wages trend downward for decades. Entitlements and welfare have become obscenities, right? There is less of a socialist movement today than there was 100 years ago, and anti-capitalist class consciousness is hesitant to even call its name. They wouldn't mention the word working class in the last presidential election, as I recall. Class struggle is an epithet cast accusingly at the mildest offenders. But Allen also thought, but he saw unmistakable signs of a maturing social conflict, which I think we sense, is need for, and we perhaps getting close. And he emphasized the important fact that America of today bears the indelible stamp of the African-American civil rights struggle of the 60s. We have been influenced by that. We have something that points a direction forward. We understood how that struggle from the bottom of society, but putting the struggle against white supremacy at the center, is a catalyst for so much effort for social change. And in his final words, he hoped that perhaps by virtue of that legacy, the great safety valve of white skin privileges would come to be seen and rejected by laboring class Europeans as the incubus, the devil that for three centuries has paralyzed their will in defense of their class interest. All of this is elaborated in much greater detail with footnotes and sources and references and for free on my webpage in this article, top left. Thank you.